session number 6818, Reel 1.
General Moulton, Reel 1. General, can I ask you first why you joined the Royal Marines in 1924?
I think for two main reasons. First, my father was in the Royal Navy. In fact, I was born in a naval house at Pembroke Dock and spent the first 7 years of my life there. And secondly, my father was retired for age, the age of 60, in 1913, and my mother was left to bring up three boys on an uninflated pension. So by 1920, we were fairly hard up. And in fact, by the time I was finishing school in 1924, I don't think there was much question of being able to afford the fees at Sandhurst or, of course, the university. The Marines and the Naval Special Entry, in fact, took you without fees and, in fact, paid your princely sum of 6 and 8 pence a day while you were what was called a probationary second attendant in the Royal Marines.
So it's a matter of economic necessity and family background.
Well, and, yes, and sentiment, too. I mean, I think I was interested in soldiering rather than perhaps in sailing, and that did undoubtedly enter into it.
If you hadn't gone into the Marines and had had a free choice, what might you have done?
Well, it's difficult to say. I'm sorry, you asked me what I would like to... Just stop it a moment. Mm-hmm. Yes, I hadn't very many definite ideas.
So you're quite content just to follow...
Yes.
On and go into the Marines. I think after you'd joined the Marines, you were eventually sent off to serve in various ships in the Atlantic and Mediterranean until 1930, when you went up to RAF Lucas to be trained as a pilot. Why did you decide to become a pilot?
Well, I think because the Marines were a pretty frustrating outfit. Now, I didn't know this when I joined, but... the Marines, I think, had a vintage period, shall we say, in the Victorian days, but with the expansion of the Royal Navy in to meet the German menace, they became more and more ship Marines just to man the guns of the fleet. And there was a great deal of frustration, and certainly there wasn't... You could run into a very bad patch of having nothing worthwhile to do. Now, my first ship was the Rodney, and it was actually her first commission. And if I might speak about that a little, it was quite an interesting time. Because as you remember, the Nelson and Rodney, the first 16-inch gun ships with triple turrets, all revolutionary ideas, they didn't work at first. And we had a lot of technical experts, as gunnery officers, torpedo officer, and so on. And we realized the first year of that commission was unsuccessful and unhappy. Now, by a remarkable thing, they replaced these experts by real leaders. The captain was Captain Loftus Tottenham, who was a very meticulous chap. If you got through a forenoon watch with nothing going wrong, you felt proud of yourself. And it worked. You took a pleasure in that. The commander was a very vivid character, Robert Burnett, who is probably better known, as he distinguished himself in World War II. The gunnery officer was another of this type. He was killed, unfortunately, in Norway. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have risen to top of the Navy, towards the top of the Navy. And the torpedo officer, lieutenant commander in those days, was one George Creasy, later Admiral of the Fleet, George Creasy. Now, the difference in that commission was, in the second year of the commission, we were a happy ship, and not only that, but our guns worked, and our torpedoes ran. It was a lesson which I've never forgotten of the value. Leaders had to be efficient at their technical job, but they also had to inspire people to follow them.
So you could say that the lesson learned was that the human factors are more important than the material factors.
No, but the two must go hand in hand. Well, my second year in the Royal Navy, which had one of the two biggest detachments in the Marines, by what I can only say is some rather clumsy drafting, I found myself the senior of two subalterns, with a great deal to do with running the detachment. My Captain Marines perhaps was not a very vivid figure. From there, I got interested in the Fleet Arm. I did this short air familiarity course in a carrier, and was taken up in the back seat a bit, and I liked it very much. But when I got back into barracks, I almost at once found myself drafted as the only subaltern in the 2nd Fleet Flagship in the Mediterranean. And there, one was back in a really frustrating job. So I'd once applied to become a pilot. I never regretted it. And I left after 5 years, which was the term of one's contract, so to speak. It wasn't, of course, not a literal contract. You, under regulations, you were said if you volunteered for pilot, you took on for 5 years. Because it was rather a dead end for Marine. One of my great friends, Nigel Skeen, who was killed, was went to fly one course before me. He was a year younger than I am. And I often wondered where he'd have got to, but unfortunately he was killed in the war.
You say it was frustrating being subaltern on board a ship. What was the principal cause of the frustration?
Really, I suppose, if we go dig a little deeper, it was that there was no real distinctive role for the Royal Marines. You were trained, you had a military training, plus a naval, one was taught naval gunnery and things like that. But it didn't seem, I don't think it fundamentally made much sense. A junior officer in those days had a fairly dull and onerous time, I think, by modern standards. One had to keep watch in harbour, which was always fell on the junior officers, and it was a dull and onerous job, and it was leading nowhere. Why a Marine felt this more than a sailor? I think because a sailor of the same age as myself would also have been a sea watch keeper, and he would look forward to going perhaps to a destroyer or submarines or going to Fleet Arm.
But you were always in the larger ships.
Hmm?
You were always in the larger ships.
Yes, indeed. I think cruiser marines had a better time. It was a job one would have liked to have been sent to.
How many Marines were there in the detachment on the Royal Navy?
Well, I can tell you the actual number. It's stuck in my head of Marines, that's private soldiers, so to speak. It was 117. And you've got to add to that NCOs. And then we had a chap called a Royal Marine Gunner, who, unlike the Royal Artillery Gunner, he was a warrant officer. Equivalent to a rather senior, higher status than a regimental sergeant major, and he put a gunnery expert. We had two subalterns in a private battleship and one Captain Marines.
Did you ever do any landing operations exercises when you were...
Yes, we used to play at them. It was very much play at them. We would practice landing people in pulling cutters. We even went to Northern Ireland, where we took three battalions from an infantry brigade there, and we all gave them a short course rowing ashore in cutters. And I remember standing up and telling these chaps how to row a boat and so on. We did have an annual camp at Wilsworthy on Dartmoor, and that, in fact, I think held up my going to Fleet Arm by about a year. Because I was rather inspired with what was going on. A few subalterns of the fleet were attached to this. It was probably, may have been a battalion, I don't think it was a full battalion, but something like that. That rather got me interested again. This wasn't so frustrating. We were doing what we'd been trained to do. And that's why I delayed, in fact, my application to join the Fifth Arm and tried to get a machine gun course. Of course, while I was waiting, they had me off to the Ravens and Mediterranean.
When you say you played at landing operations, how many men could you get into one of these cutters?
It's a bit much for my memory now. There was a... if you said 20, it's a bit of a guess, actually.
When you actually did these practice landings, was it assumed that there would be an enemy on shore opposing you? They were assault landings.
And one realised, of course, one was hopelessly vulnerable. I remember we did another one up in at Invergordon, and while we were pulling ashore with our cutters, some Fleet Air Arm fighters came and shot us up. Well, we were actually sitting ducks.
What means of communication did you have to try and keep the landing force in touch with the ships?
I really couldn't tell you. Very little, I should think. And pretty very primitive, too.
Would it have been semaphore or something?
I doubt if... I don't think they had wires. I think the Marines were trying to blind themselves to the fact that wires ever existed. I had a brother in the Corps who was a signals officer. He's dead now, unfortunately. He got into trouble, became very frustrated, really, because he tried to introduce some rather advanced things from the post office and finished up with a nervous breakdown.
What sort of armament did the Marines carry? Was it standard infantry?
Standard
armament?
Infantry. That was, you had the platoon of four sections, two Lewis gun sections, two rifle sections. The platoon headquarters, of course. But, of course, you couldn't get much beyond that. You couldn't have any transport. We used to pull handcarts about. I won't snare at handcarts too much. Later on, I saw them used with some effect in Diego Suarez in the first hours of the landing. But the typical... I remember I later on started machine gun course. I'll get back to that later. One of the sayings was, as you know, the infantry machine gun officer had a horse, and the instructors used to say, now the section officer comes riding up on his horse, what he ain't got.
Did you have any bicycles?
Yes, I think a few. I don't remember. I don't think in the ships we had any.
When you practiced your tactics at the annual camp, did you have the same sort of infantry tactics as the army?
Yes.
Was there a distinctive marine style?
We were much more closely identified to the army. Well, not much more. We were, in general, rather more closely identified to the army than perhaps we are now.
Did the sailors on the ships do any training for land warfare?
Well, I think they did some, but it was obviously less than the Marines, and the Marines didn't do very much.
Did you ever have joint exercises with sailors?
I can't remember one. There's no reason why we shouldn't.
When you were actually on board the ships, how could you keep the Marines occupied? Was it...
In maintenance duties, in cleaning the ship, and in ceremonial... I put it cleaning the ship first, because that's how they spent most of their time.
Scrubbing and painting.
Yes, the Marines always used to... were responsible for what were called the wardroom flats. The flats were the decks from which the wardroom officers' cabins opened out from. They had quarters in floors with brass strips which had to be washed and the strips polished every morning, and paintwork cleaned, and they had other duties of that nature. Primary warlike duty was manning their share of the armament of the fleet. In the Rodney, we had one 16-inch turret and two 6-inch turrets, the secondary armament, one on each side. I, the subaltern, had one of the 6-inch turrets.
Did you do any live firing through this turret?
Oh, yes. Quite a lot. Now, that's how we found out the 16-inch turrets weren't very good. I think they got over the troubles in the end. In fact, we were already, by the end of the first commission, beginning to get results.
What about 6-inch guns? Were they easier well, to handle?
As a young officer, one did a gunnery course at Wayland, where, of course, we were taught on 15-inch turrets and 6-inch battery guns, mounted, which were hand-worked. The 6-inch shell weighed 100 pounds, which was supposed to be the limit the man could lift and load with a reasonable degree of speed. By the time they built the post-World War I construction, they had come to conclusion that they should have that 6-inch should be power worked and in turrets. So the Nelson Rodney had twin 6-inch turrets on each side.
Now you mentioned the annual camp at was it Willsworth, eh? The Marine annual camp.
Yeah.
Yes. How long did that last?
I think about a month. I'm not sure.
And what sort of training did you do at this annual
camp? Well, infantry tactical training. As I say, I was with a machine gun company there and got big ideas about it.
What armament did the machine gun company have?
The Vickers 303. Again, you see, you had the trouble of what you were going to carry it in, and they were carried in, they were done by hand carts.
Did the Marine unit on this exercise have any mortars?
No infantry had any mortars at that time.
What sort of physical training could you do with the Marines when you were on ship?
It's difficult to say. Occasionally they used to have some in the morning. I think it very much depended on the commander. I can't really remember much about it.
Must have been rather difficult to keep them fit for marching when they were on ship.
Yes, there was a notorious exercise in the Mediterranean when the Mediterranean had what was called the Fleet Marine Force, which was supposed to be a battalion. Each battleship was paired and would raise a company between two battleships. It became notorious because they tried to march what might have been a sensible distance in a cold day in England, in a hot Mediterranean sun. I wasn't there, but I joined the Glorious shortly afterwards, and I heard a great deal from people who watched this exercise from the air.
There's a high rate of...
People falling out.
What sort of exercise would you... what sort of distance would you consider sensible for a day's march?
I missed that.
What sort of distance would you consider sensible for a day's march?
Well, the standard march in the drill book was 20 miles. I think 15 to 20 miles. And I don't think in those conditions, had they been fit and used to it, they could probably have done 15. But the Mediterranean can be very hot in the summer.
Did they have any difficulty with marching when they were on their annual camp in England?
No, they used to start off by... In fact, that battalion or whatever I was with in Willsworthy marched out from Plymouth Barracks and marched up to Willsworthy in a day's march. And that's over 20 miles. And it's not all flat at all. It's going up onto Dartmoor. In fact, a chap who was known by name, a subaltern known as Mad Morris, for a bit, marched back the next day by himself.
What was the general character of the exercises you did at Willsworthy? Were they mainly offensive or mainly defensive in their orientation?
I would think both. I think it's fair to say that the whole of British infantry were at that time, in the 1920s and early 30s, were trying to ignore the lessons of World War I. I do remember at my OTC camps when I was at school seeing a few tanks. They seemed absolutely invulnerable. I don't know how much the regular infantry saw of armour. I would say, from what I've read, not very much. So you then had the problem of how does an infantryman attack against machine guns without armour, was fairly limited artillery support. That argument was still going on when I was at the Staff College in 1938-39. I remember an article in the Army Quarterly by some officer who called his article Cenotaph Tactics. I think it is fair to say from perhaps this would be better substantiated by an army officer that the infantry in attack didn't carry any real conviction. We hadn't even got 2-inch mortars. Now, 2-inch mortar smoke for unsupported infantry, if you do get in that situation, that's a great help.
Did you ever have any armour on these marine annual camps?
No.
What about artillery? Did you have support?
No.
It was just purely infantry?
Quite.
And what was the basic theory of the attack? How were you supposed to actually prepare the way and go forward?
Well, I suppose you had your machine guns, there was some covering fire, you had your Lewis guns. The platoon attack really amounted to the fact you tried to get the Lewis guns up to one flank and give flanking fire. How you did that against a continuous enemy line, I've never yet discovered.
Who did you have actually playing the enemy for you? Who did you have playing the part of the enemy?
I can't remember. I don't think we had anything. I sound very critical of the Marines about this, but I think you would have found the army infantry in much the same situation, though of course more continuous and better training. But there was not the tactical theories, infantry theories, between the wars or until the last few years before 1939. Was very unconvincing for infantry attacks.
So when you were giving supporting fire with the Vickers guns, was the idea that you should lay down beaten zones on the flanks of the advance?
Yeah. But of course, owing to being a low trajectory weapon, you would have to go out to the flank to do it.
So the Vickers guns were supposed to manoeuvre with the attacking force?
Well, no, I think they were supposed to be stationary giving fire while the attacking force moved, and then they might leapfrog forward.
Did the Marines ever make any comments upon the character of the tactical evolutions they were carrying out?
I think they... You mean the other ranks?
The soldiers, yes.
I think they tended to think of ship life as being their main... I'm sure they did think of ship life being their main task. And just what they thought about the infantry tactics, I think they probably sucked their teeth and took it and that's what they were told to do.
Now, you say this delayed your pilot training. But eventually you got up to Lucas in 1930. How long did it take to train you to fly?
It took about a year, and it could have been much quicker. It was obvious in these peacetime days that one had leave periods. It could have been much more intensive. Basically, it was divided into three parts. There was your ab initio training, which was done on the pre-1914 airframe, nearly, of the Avro 504. But by the time I got there, it had got a decent undercarriage, an oleo undercarriage, and it got a reliable engine, which was the Bristol Lynx, which was, you remember in World War One, a lot of the aero engines were rotaries. And this Avro 504 originally paired with a rotary, but by the time it got to N, it had the radial engine. It was very reliable. And certainly going back to it after service type, you felt you could put it down anywhere. It was very slow, of course, and you sat out there in the breeze, but quite a good trainer. You then did probably 3 months on a service type. It was either a fighter, this is also at Lucas, in my case was a Fairey 3F, which was one of the earliest streamlined airplanes. I mean, they didn't seem to bother about streamlining until about then. Quite a nice airplane. The difference between the 3F and the 3D, which I did manage to fly one or two, was extraordinary. I mean, 3D was a really, really cool, early part of World War One, I think. And that you then had to learn to put a bigger and heavier plane down and to fly it generally. I would say one thing about flying training, which I think anyone of my vintage must be striking as great contrast with modern flying. You were supposed to fly always expecting your engine to stop. And you were trained to keep an eye on the fields and find a field to put down on, and you, when you landed on your own airfield, you were supposed to pull your throttle back at 2,000 feet and not touch it again until you started to taxi. Now, of course, if you undershot and you did a thing which is known as rumbling, which was a thing, in other words, you eased the throttle forward, obviously better than crash. And of course, you were taken away, and you did there was a few fields around Lucas where you did a practice on an actual field. But these heavier and more streamlined aeroplanes, of course, took a lot more stopping than an aeroplane.
So really, a landing was a sort of controlled glide, was it?
You did a series of S turns on the glide. You came in like that. And you hoped not to collide with anyone else doing. In fact, my instructor, about a year later, was killed by hitting a... I hope you didn't get many accidents like that. It's rather surprising that you didn't. And then the third period was service training, which, in my case, I went to be a torpedo pilot. There were four of us in my course. Henry Rolfe, retired Rear Admiral now, myself, two naval pilots, and two RAF, one of whom was Esmond, who was in those days a short service RAF officer, who'd just been removed from, who'd been 43 Squadron, the crack fighter squadron at Tangmere in those days, who'd just been equipped with the first Furies, were lovely little aeroplanes, and there he was, put to fly on an early torpedo aircraft called a Dart, which I'll show you a picture of one. I can't describe it to you. In fact, everyone loved the Dart. The classic remark about them was that somebody was standing on an aeroplane which a flight of darts started to dive onto, and he said, there they were on the in the air, on their noses, not coming any closer, so as one could see. then the other, the new the replacement of the Dart was a thing called the Ripon, which looked a bit more streamlined, was faster, but it carried, as well as a torpedo and a pilot, an observer, comeback gunner, and a rather more of a wireless set. The result was it was very much underpowered.
Who actually did your training? Was it a naval pilot?
Oh, no, it was RAF. One had a naval and marine pilots had a second commissioner as a flying officer RAF. And you were trained by the RAF. The main naval base in those days was Gosport, which was the RAF base Gosport. The base was kept in, and coastal command was a relic of the old Royal Naval Air Service.